from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning. And coming up on Forum this morning, why is Congress so helpless and so hopeless? That's the question Robert Kaiser investigates in his new book, Act of Congress, How America's Essential Institution Works and How It Doesn't. The longtime Washington Post correspondent tells the story of the financial reform bill known as Dodd-Frank Act and its journey through Congress and what the passage or failure to pass a bill says about our larger democracy today. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Robert Kaiser joins us for this morning's opening Forum Hour, a half-century staff member with The Washington Post as a reporter on Capitol Hill and an associate editor, as well as a correspondent in Moscow and Saigon, and a senior correspondent and managing editor of The Post. He's the author of Russia, the People and the Power, So Damn Much Money, which we featured on Forum, and The News About the News, which he co-wrote with Leonard Downey Jr. He's also written for Esquire, Foreign Affairs, and the New York Review of Books, and is a recipient of a National Press Club Award and an Overseas Press Club Award. And with firsthand access granted to him in the preparation, political process, and ultimate passage of the Dodd-Frank U.S. financial sector regulation legislation, he recently published Act of Congress, How America's Essential Institution Works and How It Doesn't. And we welcome Robert G. Kaiser back to Forum on this morning's opening hour. Bob Kaiser, good to have you with us.
Michael, a great pleasure. How are you doing?
Okay, and you?
Not bad.
Good.
You're an older guy.
Well, that's about sometimes
half a century of experience.
As good as it gets when you get up in these older years. I'm fascinated by this book, particularly since you cover the Dodd-Frank bill, which was kind of a perfect storm and happened, as you pointed out, mainly because of the catastrophe on Wall Street. But we learn a lot about, as the subtitle suggests, how Congress works and how it doesn't work. This was, we should say, though, right from the top, atypical. You had in the 111th Congress, you had a Democratic majority, president behind it, and kind of, as I said, a perfect storm.
Correct. I hope that the lessons about Congress, I'm sure that they still apply, but this was a very unusual situation. And the crash of the fall of 08 was the key event, where the Democratic majorities were necessary, but nothing would have happened without the crash. The crash scared the pants off everybody in Washington, as you know. And it's fear, I realized, working on this book. Fear is the great motivator that makes Congress operate when it has to.
Well, there are some real revelations in this book about how Congress operates and how it doesn't operate. And today's Congress, I suppose, the culture that you write of is possibly even more hostile to compromise than it was back when you had all this access to the Dodd-Frank bill.
It really is. We now have essentially a dysfunctional culture, one that has no room for compromise, which is simply amazing. I was stunned and impressed by Bob Dole, who went on Fox News a few weeks ago and said the Republican Party should be closed for repairs because everybody's forgotten how to make a deal. And that was remarkable to me that Dodd would say that, but it wasn't remarkable in its content because it's so obviously the case. We saw it last week in this humiliating vote for Boehner on the farm bill, where the Republicans simply would not follow their leadership. We're in a really difficult moment now, and it's going to get worse. You know, this fall, when the debt limit comes up again, I don't see how they're going to avoid a real catastrophe.
Well, I want to talk to you about some of the bills that are pending, particularly the immigration bill, but the bills like this one, after the catastrophe of Wall Street, was so technical with derivatives and the like that the staffers become really empowered. Those staffers who often become higher paid lobbyists to essentially usher these bills through and to do all the preparation. You've got very few. I think you compare it to maybe a Major League Baseball team with those who really have, the smarts and the information and the policy wonkiness that's necessary.
Yeah. Absolutely right. In my preliminary reading, I read Teddy Kennedy's memoir, which came out just after he died. It's a wonderful book. He reveals a state secret. He says 95% of the real work on legislation now is done by the staff. This, says Kennedy subtly, represents a substantial reallocation of responsibilities in the modern era. It sure does. Staff, in this book, you see two women who are not famous in Washington or anywhere else, the senior staff people on each of the committees, the Senate Banking Committee, the House Financial Services Committee. These two women were the key people in the story, as far as I'm concerned, and they're the heroes of my book, besides Dodd and Frank themselves.
Well, let's mention them, Amy Friend and Jean Rossenwalk, who people would not know by name.
That's right, and they're two terrifically smart lawyers, Jean from Yale Law School, Amy from Penn Law School, first-class intellects, very serious, very good at politics, very good at congressional maneuvering, and very good at substance. And they were friends of one another, and they both had remarkable colleagues as well, really bright people. I'll tell you, Michael, we're really lucky as a country to have still some very competent... Hello, are you there?
Yeah, I'm right here.
Sorry, I thought I screwed up the phone. Very smart, very sensitive, very thoughtful people who will take these jobs. These two ladies made about $165,000 a year doing this work. They were dealing with lobbyists every day who make $1 million a year or more. It's quite a remarkable thing that they were willing to do it. But it works. The system works only because they have these people up there who know how to make it happen.
Well, even the hearings themselves are organized and scripted by staff, as you point out. And when you get anger, as you did after this catastrophe on Wall Street, it's anger that's fairly, to a great degree, orchestrated for political purposes. In fact, we're talking, aren't we, Bob, more about politics on Capitol Hill than we are about legislation when it
right.
comes
to me, that's the crucial point. Lee Hamilton, the wonderful old congressman from Indiana, said this to me as I was beginning work on the book. And it just, it's haunted me ever since. He said, when I was a young congressman in the 60s and 70s, I and a lot of my colleagues, we were interested in policy. We wanted to fix the country, make it better. We had a lot of interesting substantive concerns that we pursued. He said, but sometime starting in the 80s, politics began to displace policy. And today, very few members of Congress are either well-informed about policy or even care about it. Political warfare is the game played today by most members of both houses, and it's a very discouraging phenomenon because, as you said, as I conclude in the book, you could have fit the number of real experts in the House and Senate on financial regulation easily onto the roster of a Major League Baseball team. There weren't two dozen of them. Now Dodd and Frank have retired, so the number's even smaller.
But they're all about also raising money, and that has to be emphasized to the citizens, that we have a system that really doesn't allow for the sort of time that's necessary if they wanted to be policy wonks because they're so busy trying to get reelected and raising the money to get reelected.
You and I talked about this about my last book, which was more focused on the money in Washington, but this, here you see it again. Members of Congress routinely now have to spend 1, 2, sometimes 3 days a week making telephone calls to strangers begging for money. It's totally demeaning. It's corrupting, obviously. But it's also appalling if you think about it. We're paying these guys, presumably, and gals, to be full-time members of Congress. But full-time members of Congress now think that the job, you know, a big hunk of it is making those phone calls, dialing for dollars, they call it. And I don't know why good people would put up with this. Of course, a lot of them don't. It's a sad commentary.
We're talking to veteran correspondent and reporter and editor Robert Kaiser, who's with us by phone this morning from the nation's capital. He's associate editor and senior correspondent with the Washington Post and author of a new book called Act of Congress, How America's Essential Institution Works and How It Doesn't. And Bob Kaiser, I think it's safe to say that it doesn't work often also because of the lack of relationships. And one reads a great deal about this in general. I'm just interested in hearing your comments. That it used to be, when you talk about Lee Hamilton days and so forth, that members of different parties would be together, would eat together, would be in the same town. You still have relationships, I suppose, cross party lines like maybe Joe Lieberman and John McCain. But for the most part, these are more obsolete, aren't they?
Absolutely. It's a very important point. Chris Dodd embodied this, and I write about it that way in the book. Chris Dodd's father, Tom Dodd, was senator from Connecticut in the 50s and early 60s. Tom Dodd, as was typical in those days, moved his family to Washington. Chris Dodd grew up here. He graduated from Georgetown Prep, a parochial high school in the suburbs of Washington. Today, almost no member of the House or Senate makes a principal residence in Washington or brings his family or her family here. The result is that they all live at home in their districts and their states. They spend a work week in Washington, which is sometimes as much as 4 days long, but is usually 3 days long, and scurry home to cultivate their home gardens in their districts. The result is that they don't get to know one another the way Chris Dodd's father, Tom Dodd, and his colleagues did. Chris recalls dinner parties in the family home in Georgetown in the 50s, where Republican and Democratic senators gathered and drank too much and slapped each other on the back and had a great time. That sort of cross-party socializing is simply gone. It's extinct. Doesn't happen. And you could even ask any member, ask your own member of Congress when you see them, who do you know on the other side of the aisle? Who's your pal? You know, they have no answer. They don't know each other. It's a tragedy, and it means that, you know, the usual grease that lubricates human interaction is just gone.
Well, we had a couple of freshman congressmen on here in Northern California, both Democrats, and they claim that they're trying to change that to some degree in the freshman class. They're meeting together and so forth. I don't know if they'll be successful, but I was certainly enlightening to hear that because I had thought it had gone like the way the dodo bird into extinction, as you suggested. But there's also, even in this Dodd-Frank bill, an important lesson along those lines because Richard Selby, for example, from the Republican side, was just about ready to make a deal, wasn't he?
He was. I think he wanted to do it. Shelby is a throwback. Shelby does make his principal residence in Georgetown. His wife was now retired, was a longtime professor at the business school at Georgetown University. And he's very comfortable here. He and Dodd were really friendly. Their wives and they went out to dinner together many times. Old-fashioned approach, in other words, like the old days. And they'd done a lot of work together. They passed a very good, in my opinion, very good credit card bill in 2009, based entirely on bipartisan collaboration. That was the model I think Dodd wanted to use for the larger regulatory bill. But Shelby, a very interesting figure, a former Democrat, an old Southern pal, Shelby did not want to alienate his own Republicans in the Senate because he wanted to fulfill what is really a lifelong ambition. He wanted to become the senior figure on the Senate Appropriations Committee, the senior Republican, an ambition in which he fulfilled last January. But because the Republican caucus in the Senate has been so changed in the modern era, it's now full of Gingrich Republicans from the House, he got the message that they just weren't interested in making a bipartisan deal. So he backed off more than once, and in the end, Dodd did, because of very careful cultivation, he got 3 Republican votes, which is what he needed to win cloture on this bill in the end, but that's all he got, and the rest of it, it was a partisan exercise.
Again, we're talking, if you just joined us, with Robert Kaiser, who's associate editor and senior correspondent with The Washington Post and author of the new book, Act of Congress, How America's Essential Institution Works and How It Doesn't. Well, of course, I'm inclined to ask you, with all your experience up on the Hill and this book, which is really quite illuminating, when you think about all the partisanship and ideology and Tea Party political warfare that is marked recent history on Capitol Hill, and for that matter, not only the partisan politics, but the gerrymandering that has allowed for people to stay in place, and a culture hostile to creative problem solving. Where do we need to go, or what can citizens do to kind of change and move the needle here?
You know, what I concluded after writing this, and let me say it was really a fun project for an old reporter like me, because Dodd and Frank agreed at the outset to let me inside and to let their staffs talk to me on the record. understanding this would all be for a book later. And the result was that I got what I think was a completely unique inside view of how the thing happens. It was this experience which led me to the conclusion that the real problem here, as you alluded to earlier, is the culture that has evolved. There's been one huge change in my lifetime in American politics, which is the transformation of the Republican Party. You and I grew up when there were people like Earl Warren and Tom Kuchel from California and all these very centrist or even liberal Republicans who were important figures in the Republican Party.
Nelson Rockefeller.
Yeah. Chuck Percy.
Out here, Tom Gavin. Campbell, yeah.
And so, you know, they go on and on. Yeah. Campbell's a good example. So, you know, those people are the dinosaurs of the Republican Party of today. They're just extinct. There aren't any more. And the Tea Party is a good symbol of what's happened. It's the new extreme Republican Party. So this is a culture. It's not something that's subject to easy change or quick fix. Cultures evolve. You know, look at the culture of Northern California over the last 30, 40 years that you've been part of it. It's become much more liberal, much more homogenous than it was, much more democratic. These changes take a long time to happen, and it's going to take a long time to fix it. So I get asked the question you just asked me. I've been asked a lot in the last couple of months promoting this book, appearing in interviews and speeches and so on. And it's hard for me because I don't have a good fix. We've got to have a much higher level of citizen engagement. People have to come to terms with the fact that we do not get, as I put it in the book, we do not get a House and a Senate that are better than we are. These institutions, sadly, accurately reflect the state of the nation and its politics. And unless those things change, they're not going to change. It's a painful reality, but it's serious because we really are all screwed up. I think everybody understands that. That's why the approval rating of Congress is 9 or 10%. But sitting around and saying this is awful isn't going to help, obviously. People have got to be willing to get involved.
And stop wringing our hands.
Yes.
I think that's good sage advice. Of course, you mentioned the Farm Bill earlier, and it did go down in not the way people had hoped. The same with respect to many people hoping for some kind of checking of the past with respect to gun legislation or gun reform also went down. But there seems to be some possibility for an immigration bill, although largely tied to politics. And yet all these amendments that are being put on now, the suspicion that it could get through because of politics is even wavering.
That's right. I love this example. You know, we talked about politics trumping policy. That's what happened here. They admit it. The Republicans, for political reasons, to please their base, had been, since 2006, adamant opponents of any kind of path to citizenship for immigrants who got in here illegally or improperly. Suddenly, they get clobbered in the election last November. The exit polls show that the Hispanic vote was heavily against them, more heavily than ever before in a presidential election. So suddenly in the Senate, we have Republicans saying, we better do something, let's pass a bill. McCain became very bitterly anti-immigrant in his own difficult re-election campaign in 2010, and then suddenly flips back again to his historic position of being in favor of a compromise, to which he's been a very important player this time around. It does look to me today as though a reasonable bill may get out of the Senate. The real question is what happens in the House, where the Tea Party caucus is ascendant, and where the leadership has no influence really over the members on these difficult issues. I do not expect a compromise on immigration to pass both houses because I don't expect it to get through the House. That's just me. I could be wrong. I'd love to be wrong.
Well, if you're right, it's going to just show to even greater extent how dysfunctional
exactly.
Congress has become. Like, the compromises can't be. They used to talk about, you know, legislation like making sausage. You don't want to see it. But now there may be a more hideous metaphor. And do you ever get flack because of the fact that I mean, you hit the GOP and the Tea Party particularly hard, and you get special access to a couple of liberal Democrats, and Washington Post, of course, is always indicted by Tea Party types as being too liberal. Does that cloud come over you as a journalist?
I'm sure it does for some people. I pride myself in always trying to be impeccably fair, as I understand the word. I had a lot of Republican help with this book, which was heartening. Spencer Baucus, the senior Republican on Frank's committee, and Shelby, we've talked about, both met with me repeatedly and were very helpful. Bob Corker of Tennessee is a very interesting figure in this book and in Washington today. He's an old-fashioned Republican. He told me he's modeled himself on certainly my favorite Republican from the 70s when I covered the Senate for the Post, Howard Baker, also from Tennessee. Howard Baker was, in my view, a great American statesman, a really serious, good guy. Not always on the same page as I in personal political preferences, but a very decent and very honest man whose principles guided his political behavior. That Bob Corker came here trying to be that kind of a guy. It's been very hard for him because this caucus is so much more conservative than Howard Baker's was. And incidentally, Howard Baker resigned voluntarily from the Senate because he found the new, more conservative members too difficult to deal with. He didn't like it, and he left. I told that story to Corker. He actually didn't know it. He didn't realize that Baker had given up because of the new right-wing forces in his own caucus. But be that as it may, Corker tried very hard to step in on Dodd-Frank, on the regulatory reform bill, to be an interlocutor for Dodd and to make a deal. They held intense meetings for a long period of time. They made an enormous amount of progress. And then Shelby and Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader of the Senate, made it clear to Corker that he'd gone too far, had to pull back, and the effort collapsed. It's one of the really good inside stories in my book that I'm proud of. And Corker helped me a lot. He was wonderful with me. He spent hours with me. So I'm sure there are plenty of people on the right who would dismiss my account and my approach here as another liberal whitewash or something of that kind. But I've decided at my age, I don't have to pay attention to those people. I have to be true to myself, try to do this the best I can, and let the chips fall as they do in May.
And we're talking to the author of a new book, Act of Congress, How America's Essential Institution Works and How It Doesn't. Bob Kaiser with us this hour, and you can be with us as well. In fact, we invite your participation in the program, and we would indeed like to hear from you. You can join us now at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. We do welcome your involvement in the program, so feel free to call us. And again, the toll-free number is available to you, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite, 866-733-6786, talking about how Congress works and how it doesn't work and the changes that have occurred, really, through the years, recent years particularly. You can also join a conversation on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. Or go to our Facebook page or email us, forum@kqed.org, or, of course, tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQED Forum. Again, the book is called Act of Congress, How America's Essential Institution Works and How It Doesn't Work, according to Bob Kaiser, because of its culture. But let's hear from you. Your thoughts are welcome. Your questions or comments are welcome. And we will turn it over to you when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Robert Kaiser, who is the author of a new book called Act of Congress, How America's Essential Institution Works and How It Doesn't. And he has been covering Congress, lo, these many years, in fact, 50 or so. He's also been, of course, managing editor of the Washington Post and reporter for the Post and a correspondent both in Saigon and Moscow for the Washington Post. We're going to go to your calls here forthwith. I just wonder, if going back, though, to the Dodd Frank bill itself, Bob, a lot of the reason this got through, we should mention here, not only, as I said, because of the times and all that, but also you're able to split the lobby between the big banks and the small banks.
Absolutely. One of my favorite stories in the book is how Camden Fine, a very colorful Missourian, whose dad, he told me, was a personal friend of Harry Truman, Amfine is now the president of the Independent Community Bankers Association of America, a very effective lobby for small banks. Camden Fine saw, very cleverly, I think shrewdly, what was happening early in 2009 as the Chamber of Commerce and the American Bankers Association lined up to oppose the creation of a new consumer protection agency as part of the new financial regulatory reform bill. Fine saw that this proposal for a consumer agency was extremely important to the new Obama administration, to Chris Todd in the Senate, and to Barney Frank in the House, the two key committee chairmen. And he thought maybe that a deal could be made that would make this thing tolerable for his members. So he went to Barney Frank after a very interesting public exchange of signals, which I describe in the book, wonderful case of Washington signal sending. They had a private meeting in September 2009 in Frank's office. Frank never told me about this meeting, but Cam Fine did, and then Barney confirmed it after I learned about it. But anyway, Cam and Barney were sitting there with a lot of Frank's aides, and then suddenly Frank said to the aides, "Would you all please leave the room? I want to have a private chat with Cam about this. This is unusual." They all left the room, and they made the following deal. Camden Fine would agree to keep neutral on the Consumer Protection Agency if Barney would agree to say, as part of the law, that banks with assets of less than $1 billion, i.e. all of Cam Fine's members, would be not covered by the inspectors and enforcers that this new consumer agency would have, that would pay attention to bigger banks but not to the small banks themselves. And if Frank would allow passage of an amendment that would change the way the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, dues were exacted from banks. Now, I'm sorry to get into the weeds here, but you have to understand the story to appreciate it. The fund, this is the fund that pays depositors in banks that go under, that fail. We all see at our own banks, FDIC insured up to $200,000. It gives us all confidence, I think, that our bank accounts are taken care of, will never go bad, which is the truth. But that fund that pays for that, because some banks do fail every year, is funded by contributions or a tax, really, exacted by the FDIC on the banks, according to a formula based on the size of the bank and other things. So, Cam Fine and his small banks had written an amendment that, in effect, shifted $1.5 billion a year of dues from the small banks to the big banks. Big banks would pay more, small banks would pay much less. This was the amendment that Cam Fine demanded that Barney accept in return for the small banks staying quiet on the consumer agency. Then Barney Frank struck the deal. They shook hands. Both parties kept the deal. This change in the dues went through. Camden Fine was able to tell his members something that Washington lobbyists usually can only dream of. "I have delivered to you $1.5 billion. And it goes right to the bottom line of all the small banks of America. So they got a huge benefit. And Barney did neutralize the opposition of the big banks to the consumer agency, which got approved in the House and ultimately in the Senate as well.
Of course, I keep thinking about the irony of Barney Frank and all the criticism he came under for encouraging borrowing from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Yes.
That's another slice of this. I mean, it's just fascinating how this legislation even got through. I mean, you know, depending on so many stars being aligned and the like. But let me get our callers on here, and we begin with David. David, join us. Hi.
It's a little bit of a history question, and I'll try to make it. I don't know if you could answer it briefly, but I'll make it hopefully. I'm often trying to explain to people my version of why what happened to the Republican Party since Lincoln, how it's evolved downward and maybe rightward. And I'd welcome your comments on that.
Hey, I've touched on this already, Bob Kaiser, but, you know, there are people who say that if you look at Ronald Reagan today, the major icon of the Republican Party, he might not quite fit into the Republican Party today. He'd be a little too far to the left.
In that interview that I mentioned earlier that Bob Dole gave on Fox News a couple of weeks ago, he said exactly that. He said, Ronald Reagan and I would not be welcome in this Republican Party. So what that points out is that the big changes that David refers to, I think they began, you know, I trace it back to the 64 Goldwater campaign, where it was the worst defeat Republicans suffered in the modern age, but also the birth of the modern conservative movement. The conservative activists who were drawn to Goldwater got together after that defeat and decided they were going to get organized, and they did get organized. They created think tanks, the Heritage Foundation, the most important example, the American Enterprise Institute, and others, and they cultivated a new conservative activist group. Ultimately, in the 80s, they brought in the Moral Majority, the conservative Christian right, which radically changed the nature of the Republican Party, and it's evolved ever since then. Then comes Newt Gingrich in the 90s. Gingrich's decision in the early 90s to demonize the Democratic Party, deliberate decision, whose purpose was to activate this conservative majority that he dreamed of and try to win control of the Congress, aided by Bill Clinton's very clumsy first 2 years in office and the victory of the Republicans in the 94 elections, which did give them control of Congress for the first time since the early 50s, the Eisenhower era. So we've had a steady progression. Downward is in the eyes of the beholder. David thinks it's downward. That's debatable, obviously. But rightward is not debatable. The political scientists have proven it. This Republican Party today is much more conservative than any preceding version in Congress anyway.
And let me thank David for the call. I wonder what you'd say to a listener, Steve, who writes the following, Bob. He says, I don't miss the backslapping culture of Washington. At least today's culture is more honest. People may be more polarized. However, there's an honesty to it, and the fact that they are going back to their districts is a good thing, not a bad thing, because it keeps them connected to their roots. Now, the end point of this may be that the Republicans end up being a minority party because their support simply isn't there, but that is not a bad thing. It's much more honest than pretending that everything is okay and that principles don't matter and that at the end of the day, everyone is a friend.
Well, this is a fascinating discussion. Steve's points are all legitimate, and I agree with some of them. I don't think it's necessary to have backslapping, but I do think it's necessary to have civility and to have collaboration. We have now a real reluctance to even show good manners. There's a wonderful anecdote in my book from Ray LaHood, who just stepped down as one of the few Republicans in Obama's first cabinet. Ray LaHood is an old-fashioned centrist Illinois Republican, a very good member of the House for many years, who agreed to come into the Obama cabinet. He and Rahm Emanuel, now the mayor of Chicago, but a former member of the House from Chicago, Emanuel and LaHood created a dinner club in the House of Representatives in the late Bush II. In the second administration, and they got Democrats and Republicans who would agree to do it to go out to dinner together just to get to know one another. And LaHood told me this incredible story of senior colleagues, he wouldn't identify them, senior colleagues coming up to him on the House floor and saying, Ray, what are you doing? That's sleeping with the enemy. What are you trying to prove anyway? What's with these dinner parties? And trying to scare him out of having the dinner party.
That's sort of what happened to Obama with his charm offensive on some fronts, wasn't it?
Sure.
Now, let me get another caller on here. We'll go to Concord. Van, you're on. Hi.
Hi. I'd like the Mr. Kaiser's perspective on considering the conflict and the gridlock in Congress, whether those of us who are interested in advancing a progressive agenda should focus on staying similar to what the American Legislative Exchange Council is doing on a state-by-state basis. I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, kind of an editorial response asked for there, Bob Kaiser, but what do you say?
Well, I'll give a reporter's answer. The Legislative what's it for called, Legislative Affairs Council, I guess, is one of the most effective groups to have arisen in this country in the last generation. They are the ones who have worked patiently and carefully at the state level to create what they call model bills that have been introduced in many cases in dozens of different state legislatures, conservative bills embodying conservative principles, and they've been very successful. A lot of them have been enacted. I don't think there's anything on the left remotely like it or remotely as effective. I don't know why it is that the people that Van supports have proven to be, over the last 30 years, relatively ineffectual compared to their conservative rivals at organizing activists. Activists are the ones that make things happen in politics. We all know that. We've seen it again and again. But the activists on the right have regularly been much more organized, much more determined, much more energetic. Look at Wisconsin, very good example, where the Democrats are thrilled with themselves because they get enough signatures to force a recall vote for the governor, who turned out to be much more right-wing than they certainly had expected. But they get clobbered in the recall election. They lose it badly because they didn't get organized on the ground in the same way.
Well, they got organized, for the first Obama election, one could argue.
Yes, they did. And for the second as well. It's an interesting evidence that they can do this. But they haven't had the patience. Patience is hard in politics. It's hard in everything. But this is Van's team, if it really wants to compete over the long run and take advantage of more than just demographic shifts, they've got to get organized in the same way, on the ground, in the states, and so on.
I wonder what you say to a listener who wants to know what you think the cultural, emotional, historical, we could go on and on, but what the real forces are that push Republicans and have pushed them farther to the right.
Well, I think we can start with a simple one. Republicans of the Howard Baker variety, the Republicans I grew up with and liked, had one basic outlook in common with today's Democrats. They actually believed in government. Nelson Rockefeller, you mentioned earlier, was a very creative user of government in New York State when he was governor for three terms. The modern Tea Party version of the Republican is essentially and avowedly anti-government. They do not like government. They do not want to help the government be better and more effective. On the contrary, they want to undermine the government. That's what's behind the efforts to try to sabotage Obamacare now by making it extremely difficult to implement it. They really want to humiliate government, embarrass government. This is a big change. This is a fundamental alteration. And I do think it's out of step with the country. I think all the polling shows that Americans, who are apolitical, after all, not very interested in following day-to-day the details of the political debate, but Americans have gotten very used to the idea that a good government provides basic services, basic security, clean air and clean water, et cetera, et cetera. There are not a majority on any of these specific issues. None of the polling that I've ever seen shows a majority opposed to the government doing these basic things. Yet many Tea Party members of the House of Representatives openly say they do oppose them. There are many who've called, for example, for the abolition of the IRS and the abolition of the EPA. Well, if we abolish the IRS, how are we going to raise any money to support any government function?
Yeah, most recently, Ted Cruz has gone on record as saying IRS, especially after the recent scandal. But this brings up, you mentioned Obamacare. He's embraced that term so we can use it freely now. The sense is that Congress on the Republican side is really, in an orchestrated way, trying to erode it and undermine it in every way they can, which ties in with what you've just said. And I'm going to ask you to put on you've already said you think the immigration bill may not even make it through. What do you think about Obamacare making it through? With all this opposition in Congress and Mitch McConnell saying, we have to oppose President Obama at all costs and, that's our main charge now, to oppose him.
I'm fascinated by this subject. I read everything I see about state efforts to register people for Obamacare, implement the exchanges, and so on. I do not feel competent to judge how this may turn out. I do keep in mind one interesting recent historical lesson. When the Medicare drug benefit, which I now benefit from personally, was passed and put into effect, it was extremely unpopular in the country. Polling showed that most people and most seniors did not like the idea of the federal government providing insurance for drugs. Well, it got implemented, and now it is one of the single most popular federal programs, according to polls, that exists. Seniors love the drug program. I like it pretty well myself. It works. It's efficient. It's easy to use. And it's really made a difference for a lot of people. And I think the hope for the proponents of Obamacare is that something similar happens this time. That, in fact, because the thing has been so misrepresented and misdescribed, because the polls tell us people have really no idea of what Obamacare is going to do and how it's going to do it, maybe if and when it gets off the ground, it's going to work out so well, as it has, for example, in Massachusetts. This is an important example. Massachusetts has Romney Care, which, as we learned, really was the model for Obamacare. It's extremely popular in Massachusetts. People do not want to touch it. So I think that's, for the defenders of Obamacare, that's the hopeful sign. But what's going to happen, in fact, I am not going to predict.
And we'll take another call, and that's Frank. Join us, Frank. You're on the air on Forum. Good morning.
Yes, hi. You discussed about what can we do, and your guest mentioned about more citizen engagement. Well, I heard of an idea where if there was a tax credit for individuals to contribute to candidates, say, for example, $200, then you'd get a lot more people contributing to their candidate of choice, and you would have a little... You wouldn't have just all the contributions coming from the rich. You'd have much, much more engagement from the citizenry.
Some thoughts from you, Bob Kaiser?
Thanks, Frank, for the thought. The truth is, I should say, first of all, this is why we need tax reform, because there are so many loopholes and tax credits and benefits in the tax code now that it's pretty much impossible to deal with. And Frank's proposal is a way to make it worse, in my opinion. But the good news, I don't think it's necessary. In fact, social media, Facebook, has proved a powerful, powerful ally of small contributions. The Obama campaign of 2012 had an unprecedented number of small contributors. Half the money they raised came in, I've forgotten what the cutoff is, but relatively small contributions. We do already have a big transformation, and I think it's going to keep going. I think it's going to go farther. One of the interesting reform ideas on the table now is to enhance matching federal funds for candidates who can raise a lot of small contributions to prove they have a lot of broad-based support. I think that's an interesting idea worth looking at. But I agree with Frank that more small contributions are a good sign. And we do have them already, which he obviously didn't realize. Whether it's enough, of course, is debatable, but it's an important change. Social media are transforming politics, and we're just beginning to see the full impact, I think. My old gatekeeper, Washington Post, the big mass media, the big national media that used to have so much influence over the national political debate, you know, we're struggling now to survive, and we've certainly lost our gatekeeper role dramatically. We're not as important as we used to be by far. But the fact that everybody can be a commentator now, everybody can be on Twitter and on Facebook, is a remarkable change, and it's having a big effect.
Well, let me thank Frank for the call. And actually, speaking of Facebook, we asked listeners on Facebook if they could change one thing about Congress, what would it be? And Well, here's Hamid who says the influence of lobbies. Kenji writes the ability of members of Congress to use private money to seek office again. And you get the picture. People are coming down on what you might expect them to come down to, again, money and influence. Robert from Florida writes, I recall when Santorum was running against Walgreen in Pennsylvania, one of the issues was that Walgreen lived in D.C. and was removed from the people he represented. Is there some sort of trade-off between being present in the district and associating with other members in D.C.? This does not seem to be a mutually exclusive issue.
Well, sadly, that's a very good comment, and that's an historic election, in my opinion. Doug Walgreen was from Pittsburgh suburbs, and that's where Santorum first got elected to the House. And here's the great irony. When Santorum got beat by Casey 6 years ago, one of Casey's most effective commercials showed Santorum's big house in the suburbs of Washington. Santorum had ignored Newt Gingrich's instructions and had moved his family to Washington. And he gets clobbered for it by the Democratic opponent who beats him in Pennsylvania for the Senate. This, unfortunately, this episode undermined the argument that I've been making, that it would be great if more members lived in Washington and got to know each other, because it showed Santorum vulnerable to exactly the tactic he had initially used to get to Washington in the first place. We have this anti-Washington strain now in our national culture, which is what this is about to some degree. I have to admit, I was born in Washington. I grew up here. I do not share in the Washington hysteria. But I wish there, but you have to take it. You have to be realistic. I think a gifted politician, Richard Shelby of Alabama is a good example, can easily cope with this criticism by going home regularly, holding a lot of public meetings, and making people realize that he's well-tuned into what's on their minds. But there aren't many gifted politicians left. And the amateurs who get into office now think symbolically. They think, you know, I'm not going to be able to convince people that I'm right with them on their own wavelength, because the truth is I'm not. But I will stay home. I'll make a big noise about not living in Washington. I'll join the anti-Washington crowd, and that'll help me get reelected.
So they're not even necessarily good politicians, you're saying. I mean, they're not good legislators in terms of their being informed about policy, but they're not even what you would call gifted politicians. In fact, many of them are certainly a lot more affluent than their constituents, and as a result, maybe are really truly out of touch.
Yes, this is a huge problem. Nobody wants to talk about it. The average wealth of our Congress, you know, is so high, so far above median Americans, ordinary Americans, it's quite disturbing. But there aren't 20 members of the Senate who aren't worth $1 million. Most members of the Senate are multimillionaires. That's not a representative body, and it has an effect. Of course it has an effect.
Lori writes, I agree, Congress is broken, but I think there are some solutions. First, we need to get money out of politics to have a chance of saving democracy. New York is working on this with a way to match citizen contributions 6-1, which has the benefit of getting citizens involved and raising enough money to overwhelm corporate contributions. I also think two steps California has taken have been very useful. First, to have a bipartisan citizen group determine the political districts to get rid of gerrymandering. And secondly, to have the two top candidates in each district, even if two Democrats or two Republicans, force the candidates more to the middle. Many organizations are concerned and working on this issue, including Root Strikers, Public Citizen, and Common Cause. And I encourage people to get involved. I think the Congress people would be relieved not to have to spend all their time raising money. And Spencer asked a kind of fundamental question, Bob Kaiser. Is there an historical example in the United States when a polarized Congress came together and started getting things done?
Let me say first, Mike, the reason I love being on your show is your audience is so smart. These are the people that ought to like this book. I hope someone will check it out. But Lori really impresses me. The problem here is that Citizens United really makes it impossible to root out the money. We can do lots of things. She's right about the New York State example. I think she's right about the California example. There's plenty of room for improvement. But there's not a solution to money in politics now without either a constitutional amendment or a different Supreme Court, and that's painful. I don't know of an example of a polarized Congress that got together to do a lot of things creatively together, but this is really because I haven't lived with a polarized Congress until the last few years, and I, you know, it's arguably the modern era of my lifetime, from the 40s through the aughts and the teens now, has been an exceptional period. America was really partisan and really divided in the 19th century. It took a long time to recover from the Civil War, beginning with Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, and extending through the 20th century, we got to a much better place. And then in the last 10, 15 years, we've started to go back in the other direction. And this has happened in the media. It's happened everywhere, much more partisan than we used to be. So the country's changing. It's always changing. The demography is changing dramatically, as you all know in California better than anybody. So we have a changing America. There's plenty of room to make it better. I haven't given up hope, but it's tough.
Well, on that note of not giving up hope, we'll come to the conclusion of this hour. Bob Kaiser, always good to have you with us. I thank you for being with us this hour.
And very good hour. Thank you.
Robert Kaiser's new book, again, is Act of Congress, How America's Essential Institution Works and How It Doesn't. We're going to welcome Khalid Hosseini back to Forum in the next hour, talk about his new novel. Please join us for that. Thank you for joining us for this hour. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Forum's produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Howard Gelman today, engagement producer Amanda Stupai, senior editor Dan Zolin, executive producer Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.